This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Last week, two reports described the scale of sexual abuse in the Catholic Church and the hierarchy's response to it. Important questions remain about the number of victims and abusers and about the role of bishops in the cover-up, but 2 years after the scandal erupted, there is at least a baseline to measure the enormity of this crisis. But any way you look at it, it has been a difficult time for Catholic priests. There was a shortage long before this scandal erupted, and 2 years of suspicion, doubt, and anger has affected morale, recruitment, and the faith of priests across the country. Later in the program, we'll talk about the news today that at least part of Mars was once drenched with water enough to support life. But first, the scandal and the priesthood. We'd be especially interested to hear from priests and from those who were or are considering the priesthood and from others affected by this scandal. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. Joining us now from Greenville, South Carolina, is Father J. Scott Newman, pastor of St. Mary's Catholic Church in Greenville. He's also director of continuing education for priests in the Diocese of Charleston. And welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you, Neil.
You've been a priest for 11 years. What have the last 2 years been like?
A challenge, a trial. When the Boston scandals began to receive national attention in January of 2002, it was, of course, not the sort of thing one wants to read in the newspaper about brother priests having committed grievous crimes and brought scandal to the church and besmirched the name of the priesthood. It didn't touch me directly, personally, though, until March of 2002.
What happened then?
On Friday the 8th of March, the Bishop of Palm Beach, Florida, resigned because he was accused and acknowledged the truth of accusations that while he was rector of a high school seminary in Missouri years before, he was guilty of the abuse of minors. And he was the second Bishop of Palm Beach, Florida, to have to resign for the same reason. At that moment, the scandal had ceased to be about the human weaknesses of priests and about the malfeasance of bishops, and it was increasingly clear to the faithful all over the country that they were really two scandals, the sexual abuse of minors by priests and the unwillingness or inability of the bishops of the United States to govern their dioceses well and properly. When the bishop resigned on March the 8th, that was for me the low point. I was, for the first time in my ministry, ashamed to be a priest.
Hmm. Did you question your faith, if not in God, in the church?
No. I was privileged to study for the priesthood in Rome, and 5 years of living in the Eternal City teaches one many things, not least among them the frailty and humanity of churchmen, of ecclesiastics of every rank. So, no, it didn't shake my faith. It did, however, awaken a deep frustration that simple things of ecclesiastical administration and normal human virtues like honesty and integrity had failed us so badly.
How has it affected you as both a pastor and as a preacher?
Well, in the days that followed the resignation of the Bishop of Palm Beach, I began to preach for the first time about the scandal. Up to that moment, I had avoided discussing it from the pulpit. But from that time forward, and on numerous occasions in the weeks that followed, I did preach, and I preached about the need for Reformation. One of our theological sayings from antiquity is the church is always in need of being reformed, ecclesia semper reformanda. And I reminded my congregation that this is true of our time and place no less than any other, and that the genuine, deep, lasting reformation and renewal of the church has always been the same, that is, conversion from sin and fidelity to the gospel of Jesus Christ, and that the answer to our crisis today would be the same as the answer to the church's difficulties in every age.
But as a pastor, you also have to deal with your parishioners, the people who come to church. I can't imagine that there's been a church in the country where somebody has not looked at you differently in the past 2 years.
Well, Yes, I have personally encountered the difficulties people have with the priesthood, not for my own congregation. For example, the day that Paul Shanley was arrested in California, he was one of the most notorious of the serial abusers in Boston and had been living for some years in California. When he was finally arrested, it was headline news on CNN. I happened that day to be flying, and I stepped out into the airport in Detroit as the giant screens had pictures of Shanley in handcuffs, and the headline said, "Priest Arrested for Raping Boys." And I was standing there in my clerical suit, and a woman looked at me with scorn and said, "Pervert." My colleagues around the country have related similar stories, and that sort of thing was to be expected. It was an inevitable result of the scandal and the attention given to the shortcomings of priests and the failure of the church to protect our children and young adults. But here in my own congregation, I found that my people responded with enthusiasm to honest discussions of our difficulties, both in the pulpit and in other forms of teaching.
Now, have you been able to talk about this with other priests in your diocese? Has there been a free exchange?
Absolutely. Every January we have a convocation of priests. Every priest in South Carolina is invited to spend a few days with our bishop, and there's a different theme each year. Just this year in January, we dedicated 3 days of conversation to the effect on priestly life and ministry, to our morale, of this crisis and of other dimensions of priestly life today. And we found it very productive, being able to speak to one another honestly about this, because, as in every diocese, some of our own have been accused.
Mm-hmm.
And being able to talk honestly about those situations served us all well.
And morale, I assume, improved after the discussions, but again, this can't have had a positive effect.
The scandal, no, of course, but here in South Carolina and in other places where the scandal has been addressed directly and forthrightly by the bishop of the place and by priests in their parishes, I think it has become an invitation for some deep questions about what it means to be a disciple of Jesus Christ, what it means to be a member of his church. And that process has produced positive results.
Joining our discussion now is Thomas Groom, a professor of theology and director of the Institute of Religious Education and Pastoral Ministry at Boston College. He's the author of What Makes Us Catholic, and he's with us from the studios of member station WBUR in Boston. Good to have you with us.
Thank you, Neil.
You've written that change is needed in the way that priests live. What are you recommending?
Well, a huge question. I mean, I think the whole culture and structure of Catholic priesthood has to be rethought. In fact, it is happening that deep changes are happening within the functions and forms of Catholic ministry. For example, there are now 35,000 lay people involved in some form of ecclesial ministry within the Catholic Church of the United States. So that's a significant shift that's happening, and I think will continue to happen. But meanwhile, I'm sure the Church will always cherish the vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience, and in order to be a vowed religious priest or sister, one will indeed take those holy vows, and there'll always be a powerful witness to the reign of God in the world. But meanwhile, I think it has to be reconsidered. The whole structures and cultures of priesthood, especially diocesan priesthood, has to be reconsidered. And I think the Church has to honestly ask the question whether or not mandatory celibacy is wise. Is it serving the Church well? Apart altogether from scandals, we're in such a dire straits right now. Boston is now facing the closing of dozens of parishes, and some of these parishes deserve to close because they've served their useful historical function, but one of the primary reasons for the closings is indeed a shortage of priests, so that we're running out of priests, and of course 10 years from now it'll be worse, and 20 years from now it'll even be worse again, so that unless the Church honestly faces the whole structure and culture of priesthood, I think our last state will be as bad as our first.
Father Newman, I wanted to ask you about that too. I assume the shortage of priests is just as a big an issue as in your Greenville, South Carolina, as it is everywhere else. And are you recruiting new priests? Are there people coming forward to take their place?
Well, in the Diocese of Charleston, which embraces the whole of South Carolina, there are presently 18 men studying for the priesthood in a diocese with 50 active diocesan priests, so we're doing well. In my own parish of St. Mary's, we have 2 men in the seminary and several more applying to begin their studies next year. So, yes, in one sense, there is a shortage. There are fewer priests now than 25 years ago in the United States. When you measure the number of priests against the number of Catholics, the ratio is not going in the right direction. But the question posed by Dr. Groom, I think, is not the path to go down. Re-examining the discipline of celibacy, offering the opportunity for married men to be ordained, in my judgment, is not the solution to our difficulties right now.
Well, I'll get a response from Professor Groom.
Well, in some ways, this is not a novel idea, Neil. Our Father Newman knows this as well. Of course, the church, the Western Church, existed for the first 1,100 years of its history with a predominantly married priesthood. And some 40 of the first popes of the church were married. And as far as we can tell from tradition and so on, 11, maybe all 12 of the apostles were married. So that this is not a new idea. This would be returning to an early practice of the church. And of course, the Eastern Church, the Eastern Orthodox churches, have never accepted mandatory celibacy. I think the value of celibacy is not to be disputed, but whether or not it should be a precondition for any function or form of ministry, I think that's what's becoming patently problematic at this particular time, especially in the Western churches. Now, there may be other parts of the church where there is a ready supply of priests and so on, but I think it also can say negative things about marriage. Vatican II, in many ways, helped marriage to come of age in Catholic spirituality, and refer to it as a call to holiness, as a consecration before God, and so on. Language that theretofore had only been used of the vowed religious life. So in a sense, if we're to live into the kind of call to, universal call to holiness that Vatican II called the church to, then pre-requiring celibacy for priesthood, in a sense, sends the wrong signal, both about priesthood and about marriage.
We know you disagree, Father Newman, but this is not a program about celibacy alone, and if it's going to happen, if there's going to be a change, I think it's probably fair to say it's not going to be happening in the immediate future. So let's talk about some of the other reforms that you, as a diocesan priest, think that you ought to be instituting there in South Carolina.
Well, the report of the review board makes this point explicitly, that the crisis in the church in the United States today was not caused by Catholic doctrine, and so the solution to our difficulties will not be found in the attempt to change Catholic doctrine. In other words, becoming more intentionally, more intensely, more resolutely, more explicitly Catholic is the path to Catholic reformation and renewal. So, for the ongoing reform and renewal of the Church, we return to the apostolic tradition, to the ancient roots of the Christian religion, and attempt to restore the form given to the Church by Christ the Lord. Dr. Groom refers to the rising number of lay ecclesial ministers at work in the United States. Here in my own parish, I have a full-time director of evangelization and discipleship, who is a layman with an advanced degree in theology. A generation ago, that task would have been performed by a priest. Today it's performed by a layman, and it works very well here at St. Mary's. But
And make it a quick but, because we're running out of time in this segment.
But the point is that the form of the church given by Christ the Lord is that the duties of teaching, sanctifying, and governing are entrusted to the apostles and their successors, and not to anyone else.
We're going to resume our conversation with Father J. Scott Newman and Professor Thomas Groom when we come back from a short break. If you'd care to join us, our phone number is 800-989-8255, or send us email totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're discussing the implications of the Catholic Church's sexual abuse and cover-up scandal on the priesthood. You're invited to join the discussion, and we'd be especially interested to hear from priests, seminarians, and those thinking about entering the priesthood. What effect has this crisis had on you and your work? Our phone number is 800-989-8255. Our guests are Father J. Scott Newman, pastor of St. Mary's Catholic Church in Greenville, South Carolina, and Thomas Groom, professor of theology and director of the Institute of Religious Education and Pastoral Ministry at Boston College. And let's get a listener involved in the conversation. Maureen joins us on the line from St. Louis, Missouri.
Hello.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
This is a very dear to my heart subject, is that my son is contemplating the priesthood at this time. He's 20 years old, remarkable kid. I'm very proud of him. The decision is not definite, but he's influenced by a good friend who 2 years ago entered the seminary. And when asked why at this time, had to respond, it's when God called me. And I asked, I talked with my son. He thought I would be so ecstatic, and I was the one more upset that he was thinking about it. And I encouraged him. I said, what about the diaconate or a lay ministry? And his response to me was so humbling that I've never been more proud in my life. It was, why give only a part of yourself to God if he's called all of you? And as far as the scandal goes, I guess a real anger that I have about it is to all those many parents who took payouts for years and years rather than going to the police and stopping it. And I would like to know what your guests think about the fact that parents didn't do as much as they could have. And I'll take that off the air.
Okay, thanks very much for the call, Maureen. Thomas Groom, let's go to you first.
Well, first of all, Maureen, support your son. Encourage him. We're desperately in need of good priests. The church will always be in need of good priests, and especially the Catholic community. This whole sacramental economy is so central to our spirituality that, in a sense, we will cease to be Catholic Christians. We might still be Christians on the Bible alone, but the whole sacramental economy is so constitutive of our identity that good priests will always be imperative to us. So support him, pray for him. I can appreciate your caution. Whether or not parents should have come forward sooner, I think that's a tough one, because you hate to end up here blaming the victim. Many of these were, I mean, priesthood has had a legendary reputation, a legendary respect, and deservedly so, entitled to it. And so when their children began to act differently or something because they'd spent an overnight at a camp or something with father, they just simply thought, well, they were going through growth spurts or pangs or puberty or prepubescence or whatever it was. I can understand why parents didn't come forward sooner. They simply, I mean, the loftiness of Catholic priesthood in most parents' perception would have put such egregious crimes beyond the realm of possibility. They wouldn't have even contemplated it. They wouldn't allow themselves to think along those lines. So that I think we can't fall into blaming victims now, or blaming the parents of victims for not coming forward sooner. I think we have to give thanks for the extraordinary grace and the courage of the people who have come forward and realize how impoverished the church would be without their courage.
I wanted to read this email we got from John in Fremont, California. One of my earliest recollections was of Mass and the beauty of the liturgy. My mother, a convert, was anxious for at least one of her sons to become a priest, and I always thought I would. However, as I approached puberty, one older neighbor in my parish went off to seminary but returned within a few months. We found out this young man had gone onto an upper story ledge of his seminary saying he would jump if they didn't let him go home. The reason, he was being sexually and psychologically abused. When I found out about all this, I gave up the goal to become a priest. And Father Newman, he can't be alone in that.
Absolutely not. Let me respond to the second of Maureen's questions and to John's email by putting this in the context of our recent history. During the 1960s, when all of Western culture was in some form of crisis or another, the Catholic Church was not immune. A young man who entered the seminary as a freshman in college in 1962 would have been handed a cassock and a beretta and a Latin prayer book, and by the time he was ordained to the priesthood in 1970, those things had been burned, often literally, and he was in a tie-dye t-shirt and blue jeans and celebrating Mass with a guitar. The transformation, the cultural, liturgical, intellectual, spiritual transformation going on inside the church in those years was a dislocation of extraordinary proportions. It's no secret, therefore, that there's a connection between that and the fact that the class of 1970 represents 10% of the accusations of abuse over a 50-year period. This was discovered by the review board in its reflection on the John Jay study.
Mm.
In other words, the chaos in the church, the instability of the church at that time, whether there's a causal connection or a correlation, there's clearly a connection between that chaos and the destructive behavior of the priests who are responsible for this crisis. But the crisis is the instability is over, in large measure because of the man who's been pope for the last 25 years. The call to heroic sacrifice for the sake of the gospel, to which millions upon millions of young Christians all over the world have responded with generosity, has now for a quarter of the century set the tone for what the church will be in the 21st century. And it's not a church of insecurity and uncertainty and chaos. It's a church of confident assurance that the gospel is true, that Christ is Lord, and that the form of the church is a given thing that we don't have to reinvent for the next generation. When that program is in place with clarity and confidence, vocations to the priesthood flourish. And then we find the odd thing that, as Maureen says, it's the mothers of the young men, not the young men themselves, who are hesitant. We had this here in my parish with three mothers.
Obviously, some young men are hesitant as well, but go ahead, Thomas Groom.
Well, Neil, if I could come in, I wish I could agree with Father Newman, but I'm afraid I can't. To blame it on the culture is a hasty implication. We don't know yet what kind of accusations will come forward, and the psychologists say that this type of reporting of this kind of abuse can take 20, 30 years later. Also, this type of abuse has taken place in cultures where that kind of upheaval that Father Newman describes did not take place at all. In my own native Ireland, for example, they have been beset by this crisis 10, 12 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly the Irish seminaries of the 60s and 70s still resemble the traditional type of seminary boot camp. So it wasn't the kind of libertine ways of the culture that caused it. Now the lid is blowing off the church in Poland, for example, and it's one of the most conservative churches probably in the world. You can go to Australia, throughout the world. So I think it's far more complex than simply blaming it on a libertine culture. I think there are deep structural cultural issues pertaining to priesthood itself, that if the church does not re-examine them, then we will have learned nothing from this sorry scandal.
Yes, but I'll give you an opportunity to respond, Father Newman, but we want to move on, get some other callers on. Go ahead. I'm sorry, Father Newman, did you want
to... Yes, I do want to respond. Dr. Groom has referred a couple of times to the culture of the priesthood, to the structure of the priesthood. I agree that a deformed clerical culture, what we would call clericalism, must be reformed, set aside, renewed. But the structure of the priesthood and the way it functions in the life of the church and the relationship between the ordained and the non-ordained, these things are not ours to tinker with. The basic form of these arrangements and the sacramental order of the church are not our invention. They're the gift of Christ.
No, they're the invention of history, Father. There is no clear blueprint. The Gospels have no blueprint whatsoever for a ministry.
Read the Catechism, Dr. Groom.
I suspect he has. Read the Gospels, Father Newman.
And I'm going to have to ask you to agree to disagree on this issue and get another caller on the line.
For your listeners, Neil, I think in the interest of disclosure, we need to point out that Dr. Groom is a former priest.
Yes, all right, fair enough. Isidoro joins us from Queens, New York.
Hi. Yeah, I have mixed feelings about all what is happening with the priest scandal. And by the way, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
And I used to be in the seminary, was there for 6 years, and I started thinking of the priesthood. Even while I really wanted to be a priest, I felt that I needed to have a family, a wife and children. So after 6 years, I left the seminary, and 3 years later, I married a wonderful wife, and I'm very happy for what I've done. So basically what I want to say, I have this mixed feeling in my heart. I love my church. I love my church with all my heart. And I was saddened, really sad when the scandal broke out, but at the same time, very happy because now we're talking about these. All Catholics all over the United States are talking about these, and I wish that more priests will be, the word will be strong enough to talk with the bishops and in the church if they can examine the celibacy. I would be a priest right now if I could be. I am married. I'm happy. My wife is expecting a baby, and makes me really happy. It makes me really sad that I cannot be a priest, since I will certainly like to be a priest right now. And I encourage all the priests that are listening to talk about this. The church needs more priests, and a lot of us will certainly consider to be a priest if we could. But unfortunately, that's something that don't let us be a priest right now.
Isidoro, thanks very much for that. I appreciate your phone call. Father Newman, again, if this is a decision the church is going to make, it's going to make it not quickly, but he and others. I wanted to ask you, though, about another thing that he was talking about, and that is the question of priests now perhaps having more cause to look at their bosses, the bishops, a little bit more skeptically, and asking them to make some reforms as well, not only on a number of issues.
Right. The review board, I think, summarizes the difficulties and the concern well. The basic point is, bishops are not managers, they're shepherds. They shouldn't behave like bureaucrats, but like pastors. And the relationship of bishop to priest is that of father to son and brothers in the ministry. And when the office of bishop is understood in those terms and exercised as a set of familial relationships within the church, there's an entirely different result than if the bishop is understood as the chief executive officer of Catholic Church Incorporated, and where the clerical culture of a diocese reflects a set of familial and Christian relationships, a positive result is expected. Where it embodies a set of business and managerial relationships, something else entirely is given. And by the way, it's where that second model takes root. Where the priest is a functionary, where he is an employee, that problems with celibacy should be expected. You know, if we're all employees or bureaucrats, why should some bureaucrats have to go home to an empty house and others not? Celibacy makes sense only in the context of a pastor's relationship to his people, of a priest's relationship to Christ's bride, the church.
And Thomas Groom, a quick response from you?
Well, I was taken aback by Isidora's story, and indeed there are thousands of such stories to be told and that are being told. My concern about all of this, Neil, comes out of my deep appreciation and love for priesthood and my love and commitment to the church. I simply see the church making poor decisions at this point in time. What Father Newman describes rhetorically is indeed sounds beautiful, but clearly it has not been taking place, this kind of relationship between bishop and priests and so on. And the kind of priestly life that he's describing is more in rhetoric rather than in reality. There are marvelous, wonderful priests indeed in our church, and we give thanks for them. Mm-hmm. But whether or not and I'd also add that Isidora is as much called to holiness of life as a married person as he was when he was contemplating priesthood. And in fact, the challenge to live a life of holiness within marriage and with children and so on may be just as demanding as the celibate life. And indeed, Father Newman is right. Yes, I have tried both. And there are times when the days in priesthood seems far easier to live a holy life than within the context of marriage and family.
I'm going to have to say thank you to you both at this point. Thomas Groom, Professor of Theology, Director of the Institute of Religious Education and Pastoral Ministry at Boston College, with us from WBUR in Boston. Thank you so much.
Thank you. You're welcome, Neil.
And
thank you.
Father J. Scott Newman, Pastor of St. Mary's Catholic Church in Greenville, South Carolina. He was with us from Greenville. Thank you also.
Thank you, Neil. My pleasure.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And with us now on the phone from New York is John Allen, Vatican correspondent for the National Catholic Reporter, an independent news weekly. He's the author of Conclave, the Politics, Personalities, and Process of the Next Papal Election. And, John, you're usually based in Rome. Nice to talk with you while you're here in the States.
Thanks, Neil. Glad to catch up with you.
You're writing a piece for the National Catholic Reporter on the impact this scandal has had on the men currently studying for the priesthood. What have you found?
Well, it's actually on the impact on men who are currently in the priesthood, actually.
Okay.
And I think, you know, the bottom line, Neil, is there is a deep demoralization in the American Catholic clergy in many ways, related both to kind of very negative public perceptions of the priesthood, also related to perceptions very widely held among many priests that the bishops have in effect kind of hung them out to dry. That is, have shifted the finger of blame from episcopal failures to the failures of priests, and adopted fairly draconian policies for priests that are not being implemented for bishops. At the same time, I think, you know, as you move across the country, as I've been doing in the last couple of weeks, speaking at various Catholic venues, I mean, what strikes you is, despite the well-documented meltdown in some aspects of clerical culture, also the incredible good work that is being done by so many men formed by that culture, who are educating the young, feeding the poor, you know, teaching and preaching the faith. And it's remarkable the vitality that continues to exist in the American priesthood, in some ways independent of the broader story of the scandal.
We spoke with Father Newman. He said in the Diocese of Charleston, things are going pretty well there in South Carolina. In terms of recruitment, is that true across the country?
I think it would be episodically true. That is, there are some places that are doing pretty well in vocations and others not. And my own sense is that, Neil, to tell you the truth, I think the liberal-conservative divide or the impact of the scandal has less to do with that than just how committed a local bishop and a local church is to generating vocations. If a bishop takes this very, very seriously, works hard at it, invests resources in it, and makes it a priority, that guy tends to do fairly well regardless of where he is theologically or politically.
You talk about the effect on morale, and you know, clearly that's going to be a long time healing. Are bishops, do you think, beginning to take steps to try to address this issue?
Well, I think they are, but the problem here, Neil, is that from the point of view of a lot of priests, what has happened as the story has played itself out is that the priests have taken the full brunt of the crisis, while bishops largely have not. I mean, as you know, we have a one-strike policy in this country for a priest who is credibly accused of sexual abuse. I mean, all it takes is one act of sexual abuse, however distant in the past, and you are, according to the policies of the church, removed from ministry for life. On the other hand, as a bishop, you can have moved pedophile priests from assignment to assignment, failing to intervene when you should have, failed in many other ways to exercise oversight, and there is no similar one-strike policy. I mean, many of those bishops are still around. I mean, Cardinal Bernard Law, obviously in Boston, resigned, but many other bishops who have committed analogous kind of failures.
And I assume until they address these issues, it's going to continue to be a morale problem. John Allen, thanks very much for being with us.
Neil, it's a pleasure.
John Allen, Vatican correspondent for the National Catholic Reporter, the author of Conclave, The Politics, Personalities, and Process of the Next Papal Election, joined us on the phone from New York. When we come back from a break, a new discovery from the Mars rover Opportunity and a remembrance of the late Marge Schott. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.